This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, reparations in Rwanda. Hutus who helped kill Tutsis during the 1994 genocide are now building houses for them.
And for the survivors, the widows, the orphans, it's our way of saying that we want to live with them. I think it's also a way to reconcile with them.
Plus, grieving and healing in Israel. Israelis and Palestinians who have lost loved ones try to break the cycle of violence.
I remember the bereaved Israeli father. He lost 2 sons. I don't know what happened to me, actually. I felt that there is something between us. We are the same.
And slave labor in South Florida. All that and more coming up on the World Vision Report. The Rwandan government estimates that more than 700,000 people have been convicted of playing a part in the 1994 genocide. That's far more than Rwanda's prisons can handle. So government authorities have instituted an unusual punishment program. Its goal is to help rebuild the country while rebuilding trust between Rwandans. From Kigali, Michael Kavanaugh reports.
About 100 men split rocks and dig ditches on one of Rwanda's patchwork hillsides. They're laying the foundations for 24 new homes, homes that will soon be given to survivors of Rwanda's genocide. But these men aren't construction workers. They're convicted criminals, the very men who may have helped burn down the houses of their Tutsi neighbors. This is Rwanda's version of community service. Each of the workers wears a dark blue vest with the letters T-I-G on it, or TIG, the French acronym for Works in the Public Interest. Origine Gatira is one of the men who's confessed to genocide-related crimes.
Alors, qu'est-ce que j'ai fait? J'ai passé beaucoup de temps.
Gatira admits he manned roadblocks during the genocide. He stole someone's cow and was present when one Tutsi was killed. For his crimes, he served 10 years in prison. He must also complete 5 years of TIG service. Gatira says he's already built more than 150 houses around the country, and he's building 20 more at this site. He says building homes for victims of his crimes is a meaningful form of punishment.
And for the survivors, the widows, the orphans, it's our way of saying that we want to live with them. I think it's also a way to reconcile with them. Still, you've given them a house, but I don't believe it's enough. I wish there was something to give them besides a house.
Some survivors are suspicious. Benoit Kibuye is the executive secretary of IBUKA, one of Rwanda's genocide survivor organizations.
I don't know if you can call it reconciliation. You have destroyed the house, you are building a house. Where is reconciliation? Because you cannot repair, you cannot restore lives of those who are perished.
Some survivors complain that the TIG program is too lenient, even though right now only low-level perpetrators are enrolled. But in post-genocide Rwanda, that could mean someone who killed up to a few people. The perpetrators get to live in camps on the building sites instead of behind prison walls. But many survivors are afraid they'll have to relive their trauma if they see these confessed murderers in public view. Still, some of the genocide survivors, the ones who end up in houses built by the TIG program, say this is the first step to restoring some of what they lost. Patrice Uimana struggles to open her kitchen door. She only moved into her new home 4 days ago, and she's still getting the hang of the lock.
This is like a little kitchen?
27-year-old Patrice and her sister, 24-year-old Skoldine, are some of the first survivors to move into a home built by the TIG program. The house is small, 5 little rooms with dirt floors. The cement walls are bare, except for a small framed prayer hung in the living room. During the genocide, Hutus burned down Patrice and Skoldine's old house and killed their parents and siblings. For more than a decade, the two sisters have moved from house to house throughout the countryside.
This helps a lot considering what we've been through. You kind of lose your mind and start feeling very helpless. So getting a house can help you.
Patrice says this house could never replace their old house and farm. It's like a small salve on a giant wound.
It
requires a lot of tolerance. These people still have bad hearts. But on our part, we've forgiven them. And in our case, when we get something good, like this house, we can try to live another life. We're trying to start all over again.
Patrice locks up her kitchen door to keep her sacks of grain safe from animals. She walks back through the house quietly. The sisters don't have much furniture or many personal belongings, so it doesn't quite feel like a real home yet. But hopefully one day, soon, it will. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michael Kavanaugh in Kigali, Rwanda.
As in Rwanda, distrust between the opposing sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict often prevents constructive dialogue. It's not difficult to understand why. The conflict has claimed thousands of lives over the years. Those deaths on both sides often fuel more anger, more revenge. But not everyone reacts that way. Shia Levitt brings us this report from Jerusalem.
Rami Elhanan grew up in Israel, the son of a Holocaust survivor. He fought in the army and lost many friends in the Yom Kippur War. He'd never met a Palestinian person, though, and never thought the Israeli-Palestinian conflict directly affected him until September 1st, 1997, when his daughter Smadar was 14 years old.
It was the first day of school. She was a very good student, a very vivid and sparkling and joyful girl, millions of friends. She was going down Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem to buy some new books for the new year with friends. And there were two suicide bombers.
Elhanan was on his way to the airport when his wife called with the news that their daughter was missing. He ran from hospital to hospital, but his search ended at the morgue.
Five people were killed that day, and Smadar was killed with her best friend, almost hand in hand.
Just a few miles away from where Smadar was killed is the West Bank town of Bet Omar. That's where Ali Abu Awad grew up. His mother was active in Fatah, the political party of the PLO, and when Abu Awad was a child, she was jailed several times for her involvement. As a teenager, Abu Awad joined the Intifada himself and spent time in prison after being accused of throwing stones. In 2002, he was shot by an Israeli settler. As he lay in a hospital bed, he learned that his brother had been shot and killed by a soldier.
Having those heart conditions is making me losing my control. Being shot, losing my brother, still tasting the same taste of suffering daily, it's making me sometimes crazy.
Both men did something unusual with their pain. They were invited to meet and share stories with grieving family members on both sides of the conflict, and they accepted.
I remember a bereaved Israeli father. He lost two sons, one of them by a suicide bomber. When he talked and when he cried, I looked to my mother and she was crying. Actually, most of the people there start crying because he talked as a human, not as a politician. And it was the first time that I saw the tears. I don't know what happened to me, actually. I felt that there is something between us. We are the same.
Abu Awad and Elhanan both joined the Bereaved Families Forum. It's a growing organization of hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians who've lost family members in the conflict. They want to help their respective communities understand that Israeli and Palestinian pain are the same, and that ending the conflict is in the best interest of both groups. They tour Israel and Palestine to speak to people on all sides of the political spectrum.
Good morning to you all. Thank you for... Come and listen to us.
Today, just outside Jerusalem's old city, Elhanan is speaking to Israeli and American students. He's just told the audience about his initial feelings of rage after his daughter was killed.
But after a while, you start asking yourself questions. If causing someone pain will ease in any way my own pain, well, the answer is certainly no.
Lectures like this one have two speakers, an Israeli and a Palestinian. They talk about their personal losses and what made them decide to work toward peace.
I think we are open for questions now. Don't hesitate. We will try to answer the best we can.
The audience asks their opinions on the two-state solution, the West Bank withdrawal, and whether peace activists really exist on the other side. The bottom line, they say, you need to understand other people before you can compromise with them. Some people who attend these lectures challenge the speakers, and sometimes there are even insults. One Israeli widow was told her husband deserved to die because he served in the army. A Palestinian speaker was called a terrorist. But more often, they say, the audience response is overwhelmingly positive.
My name is Ali Abawad. I'm coming from a refugee family. I grew up in this conflict. I grew up feeling about the other side, that they are our enemy.
On a recent evening in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's old city, Ali Abu Awad is speaking to American students here with a study abroad program.
Before 2-3 years, I was carrying my people and their behavior on my back. I was carrying my brother on my heart until now. But today I'm carrying the both nation, because when you start being a peacemaker, you feel responsible about everybody.
After the lecture, students swarm around Abu Awad and his co-speaker, an Israeli widow. The students are full of personal questions.
Where was your refugee camp?
It was not a refugee camp. It was my town, Beit Jibrin, which is near Beit Shemesh. Then, after 48, my family moved out. They left as so many Palestinians.
Back outside the old city, Israeli Rami Elhanan says his work with the Bereaved Families Forum is about reconciliation, not forgiveness.
You cannot forgive the killing of the innocent. I'm trying to overcome my feelings, the natural feelings of everyone whose daughter somewhere was murdered brutally, and try to prevent this unbearable pain from others.
Both Elhanan and Abu Awad say the simple act of talking to the other side is the first step toward peace. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shia Levitt in Jerusalem.
Later in the program, we hear about a cafe in Israel where Jews and Arabs are regular customers. Stay with us for that. And now, here's our globe at a glance. Crime is soaring in the West African country of Liberia. When the civil war there ended almost 5 years ago, thousands of young soldiers returned home. But few of them have found jobs, so many have turned to crime. Now the government has come up with a novel way to fight crime. It's giving away free mobile phones so that people can call the police. Many Liberians already have mobile phones, but they're reluctant to use them because of the cost. Now, communities around Monrovia, the capital, will be given 10 phones each. They'll be pre-programmed with a free police hotline to report crimes. And there'll be a prize for the community that reports the most crimes. While many residents welcome the plan, others worry that giving people mobile phones will make them targets of crime rather than reporters of crime. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. You're listening to the World Vision Report. Slavery was abolished in this country more than 140 years ago, but it's still thriving in a slightly different form. These days, there are workers, usually immigrants, who are kept in factories and fields against their will and threatened with violence if they try to leave. That's according to author John Bowe. He's the author of a new book called Nobodies, Modern American Slave Labor and the Dark Side of the New Global Economy. We spoke to him about one of the stories in his book, a slavery case against a labor contractor in southern Florida. The man's nickname was El Diablo, the devil. The workers he managed picked vegetables and fruits for well-known companies like Tropicana and Minute Maid.
One of these workers I wrote about was, his name was Garcia Orozco, which is a name I made up because I can't use his real name because he's still living in fear of retribution. But he and a couple friends came up from southern Mexico. They crossed the border, and they crossed the desert into Arizona. And their coyote who got them across the border said, here, wait here in this, you know, shack. And they waited a few days. Then they got a ride from some guy they called Shorty. And Shorty gives them a ride along with about 20 other guys in a van to a town called Lake Placid, Florida. And they get out after not eating for several days, and they meet their new boss. And their new boss says, well, you owe Shorty $1,000 for the ride. And of course, this is completely arbitrary. There was another labor contractor who said, you owe the guy $7,000 for the ride. They can say whatever they want. And these workers are in the swamps in Florida in this tiny town. They have no idea where they are. And they just shrug and say, yeah, okay, whatever. And so the boss says, okay, I'm going to pay Shorty, but you're going to be working for me and you can't run away. And so, you know, this guy starts working, and first week, the boss takes out money for the ride from Arizona, and he takes out money for the housing, he takes out money for the food, and then with what little money they have left, they have to buy their groceries at the boss's wife's grocery store, which charges really high prices, so it's the old company store thing. And at the end of working a 70-hour week, they're getting like $30, $40 a week.
Do they complain at this point?
Well, it's hard to complain to a boss who says he's going to whack your face or shoot you, which this boss was saying. He was saying, like, you keep up that attitude, I'm going to pump you full of lead. And there was a pond, sort of a lake thing, behind the barracks where these guys were staying. And it really was full of alligators. And the boss and his henchmen would routinely say stuff like, you know, we're going to throw you to the alligators. And boy, are those alligators hungry.
And did that ever really happen?
In different occasions, yeah. You know, all of the workers who worked for him were really intimidated because this guy had a reputation as being a bit like a gangster. So, for example, one time they were walking to a convenience store half a mile down the road, and they were just about there, and their boss, El Diablo, shows up in his car, and he said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we're just going to go use the phone." He said, "Well, why don't you go back home? I think it'd be better if you go back home." You know, and so this is constant feeling of, okay, you can't leave. And the words that this guy used, he said, so all of a sudden you realize you're completely in their pocket.
What kind of violence is actually done to workers who try to leave, who try to get out of that situation?
Well, in this case that I wrote about, violence had been done several times. I don't know how many times it happened that I didn't hear about it, but there were people killed. There were people pistol whipped. You know, all of this came out in police documents and court documents. You know, the guy was found guilty of forced, you know, involuntary servitude by a federal court.
What laws are in place that would prevent labor contractors from holding migrant workers against their will?
Well, ever since, you know, the end of the Civil War, the 13th Amendment is very clear. And they update that from time to time. In 2000, they passed a sort of new anti-slavery bill that was taking into account these kind of situations where there's a lot of coercion. And it's not easy to prove. You know, there are a lot of people at the Department of Justice and in the FBI who are very concerned about this stuff because they suspect that it's really, really increasing. But it's very hard to go talk to a bunch of foreign people who are migrant workers who have, you know, they're scared of the cops, they're scared of the government, and to convince them, yes, we want you to stay in one place while you're scared of your ex-boss beating you up, and cooperate with us for the 2 or 3 years it will take to have a trial, and we can't pay you. It's very hard for these guys for prosecutors to mount an effective legal case. So a lot of times this doesn't get prosecuted.
How many workers in America are really living in these kinds of slave conditions?
I you know, that's something I shouldn't speak to because no one has the expertise to answer that. I mean, if we had Department of Labor inspectors who spoke Spanish, they could do this work of finding out, like, what really is going on in our country. But we haven't been good about hiring people to deal with this population. Instead, we've been ignoring them. And so what's going on out there, we don't know. There have been 6 cases that have been successfully prosecuted just in South Florida. You talk to the prosecutors, you find out, you know, it's probably 1 out of 100 or 1 out of who knows how many that actually get prosecuted.
Okay. John Bowe, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
John Bowe is the author of the book Nobody's Modern American Slave Labor and the Dark Side of the New Global Economy. He spoke to us from New York. When women in the U.S. want a manicure, they often head to a discount nail salon. These shops are usually run by Asian immigrants. Scientific studies have shown that products used in the salons contain chemicals that can cause asthma and other health problems for workers who are exposed on a continual basis. Because of language barriers, many salon workers may not be aware of these health risks. Now, there's a campaign to teach nail workers how to protect themselves. Anne Dornfeld reports from Seattle.
Helen Huang sculpts a customer's acrylic nails in her salon, North Bend Nails. Huang was a nurse in Vietnam before she moved to the U.S. 20 years ago. But going back to school to learn English and then for her nursing license seemed out of the question.
Very good. Yeah, I don't want to be good. I come here with the big family. I need to take care of the five kids. I work too hard. Don't have time. Now I just understand English a little bit. Yeah. I don't have time to go to school.
For a while, she worked in a sewing factory making backpacks and parkas. Then 7 years ago, Huang opened this small nail salon on a busy street in South Seattle. She spends her days chatting with customers as she works on their nails. Her table is covered with containers of strong-smelling chemicals. Nail polish and remover are just the beginning. Right now, for instance, she's turned on a fan while she mixes up the liquid acrylic for her customers' nails.
I use two products for this. One product is mixed with powder to make the powder supple so I can paint it on. And the other one is a polymer to finish it off.
It's a pungent paste. Like many nail technicians, Huang wears a small mask. But Kevin Burrell says that's not enough. He heads the nonprofit group, the Environmental Coalition of South Seattle.
The masks that are being used in the salons are dust masks, and that's it. They filter no chemical whatsoever.
Nail polish is full of toxic chemicals, like formaldehyde and toluene. Burrell says the chemistry of nail polish is similar to auto paint, and they're applied the same way.
A primer, a mid-coat, and then a top coat. Well, the guys and gals that do that within the auto painting industry wear respirators and full body suits.
That's because the chemicals in auto paint and nail polish can cause headaches and irritate the skin and lungs. In studies on lab animals, some of the common chemicals in nail polish have been shown to affect the nervous system, cause organ damage, and even birth defects. Of course, nail salons aren't working with huge amounts of paint, but Burrell says polish and remover aren't the main concern.
I think the things that poses the most risk are the actual acrylic nails and the monomers that go in to build those nails. They produce a lot of off-gassing.
There haven't been many studies on worker exposure in nail salons, so it's hard to say how harmful these exposures are. But some research shows the chemicals used to make artificial nails may cause allergic reactions and respiratory problems. A lot of salon workers are Vietnamese immigrants, so language barriers may prevent them from understanding how to properly handle these chemicals. Burrell's organization is working on a campaign to teach them. It's called the Toxic Beauty Campaign, and it's funded by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Another local group, the Community Coalition for Environmental Justice, is also involved. Secret Charles is an outreach specialist with the group. Charles says people who work in nail salons can be oblivious to how strong the fumes really are.
People that don't go into the nail salon that often, when they first go in, it's a huge impact. But if you go into the nail salon often enough, you become immune to it or desensitized, similar to a person working in an environment with cigarette smoke.
The Toxic Beauty Campaign sends a Vietnamese-speaking educator to salons to teach owners and workers how to minimize chemical exposure. One key step is airing out the shops, both through low-tech measures like opening windows and by installing high-tech ventilation systems. The workers are taught to keep nail products tightly sealed and to pour bulk chemicals into small bottles to use at workstations. At North Bend Nails, owner Helen Huang says she was eager to take part in the campaign. She already had a ventilation system and air conditioner.
There's probably only a few shops that have filtration systems and air conditioners. But because I'm older, I want to protect my health, as well as the health of my customers. So I am willing to spend the extra money.
Hi, Heather. How are you?
But when she invited the educator to inspect her salon, she found out about some things she needed to do differently.
Before, I just threw everything into a trash can, but they told me to put it all in trash bags and tie the bags before I threw them away. Another thing they recommended was to install vacuums in the manicure tables to suck up the dust and fumes. I'm planning to do that.
So far, the Toxic Beauty Campaign has reached at least one quarter of Seattle's 100 Vietnamese-owned nail salons. The project is funded for 3 years, and in that time, the educators hope to teach as many workers as possible how to make their shops safer. For the World Vision Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld in Seattle.
Thank you.
Earlier in the show, you heard a story about bereaved parents, Palestinian and Israeli, coming together to work for peace. That's not a common occurrence. In Israel, Arabs and Jews rarely mix socially. But in the city of Jaffa, just south of Tel Aviv, there's one cafe that both populations frequent. Daniel Estrin discovered the place when he first arrived in Israel a few years ago. He brings us this reporter's notebook.
If you take a walk down the main drag in Jaffa, you might be convinced that this ancient city has seen its better days. Apartment fronts are crumbling, and except for a few fishing boats and art galleries priced for tourists, Jaffa's mostly a slum. But on one side street, tucked in a corner behind an ice cream shop, there's a chic white awning above glass doors. They open into a small cafe called Jaffa. There are a few tables and chairs and a small kitchen. One wall is covered with neatly stacked books in Arabic and Hebrew, an unusual sight in this country of divisions. On your first visit, Arab co-owner Michelle will undoubtedly tell you the story about the Palestinian woman who ordered the Jaffa salad. It's a traditional Arab salad served with a side of challah, the sweetbread Jews bake for the Sabbath. The Palestinian woman fell in love with the challah. Coexistence through food, Michelle beams. Michelle owns a cafe with Dina, who's Jewish. She brings the challah bread straight from her home oven. The pair doesn't get too excited about their unique establishment. Some days there are more Jews that come, some days there are more Arabs, some days they even sit with each other. Dina and Michelle don't keep score. They just think this kind of place should exist. One Friday afternoon, I was eating a bowl of mujadra, a Palestinian rice and lentil dish, when I looked around the cafe and wondered, does this place amount to more than just equal opportunity bookshelves, coexistence cuisine, and good intentions? Just then, an Israeli soldier stepped through the door. He looked about 19 years old, blonde hair, home from his base for the Sabbath. He sat at an empty table, ordered coffee, and lit a cigarette. Then he pulled a Hebrew translation of the Quran from the bookshelf behind him and started to read. Nobody else seemed to take notice. Here, that kind of thing is considered perfectly normal. If anything, I thought to myself, normalcy is Jaffa Cafe's biggest success.
Daniel Estrin is a freelance reporter living in Jerusalem. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can hear the program anytime at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up for a podcast if you'd like to take us with you. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.